Coming up on this episode of Greyhound Nation, author Leslie Wooten talks with John about her writing and her book about a Derby Lane champion greyhound. Stay tuned. The Nation is next. This is Greyhound Nation, episode 28, recorded February 15th, 2022. Leslie Wooten, Greyhound author. Greyhound Nation is a podcast for Greyhound enthusiasts produced by Greyhound enthusiasts. To learn more about our show and its hosts, visit our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. Hello and welcome to another episode of the Greyhound Nation podcast. I'm Michael Burns. Now, here's your host, John Parker.
Welcome back, everybody, to the best Greyhound podcast in the world. Tonight's guest is a longtime friend of mine. She interviewed me, and if my recollection's correct, in 2007. We'll talk a little bit more about that later in the conversation, and we've come full circle, and tonight I'm interviewing her. Our guest is Leslie Wooten. Welcome, Leslie.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Leslie, you're from a longtime Greyhound racing family. So let's start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about your childhood in Greyhound racing and your folks and how long your family had been involved in Greyhound racing.
Okay. Well, I basically started my life at a Greyhound racetrack. My father was hired as a plant superintendent of Tucson Greyhound Park when I was 2 years old. And we moved to a little house by the paddock at Tucson Greyhound Park in 1953, roughly. So I grew up, my neighbors were greyhounds in the paddock right outside my bedroom window. I heard them every night when there was racing. They were barking and carrying on. And so I really literally grew up with greyhounds. My life was a little different than some because we did live at the racetrack where the theater and the drama and all of that, the performance occurred. So, like I say, that's my earliest memories. Now, how did we get to the racetrack? Well, that is my father's story. Basically, he grew up in a greyhound racing family. His father, who was born in 1891 in California, got his first greyhound when he was about 6 years old near Hanford, California. And that greyhound was used in coursing and catching rabbits for he was hired by farmers, really, who wanted all the rabbits caught that could be caught because they were ruining crops. So for every rabbit that his greyhound caught, he got a little bit of change, you know. So so my grandfather, of course, had another career, but greyhound racing was his love. He was there in the early 30s, you know, I don't know about the 20s so much, but 30s, he was right there at Multnomah Greyhound Park racing greyhounds. And so all of his sons, he had six sons, my father being one of them, all of them went into greyhound racing. Five of them made that their life's work. And one of them became a barber because his wife didn't want him in the greyhound world. So just because of the very long hours, no matter what you were doing in that field. So my father.
So when they say it's in your blood, it really was in your blood.
Yeah. Yeah, really.
Tell
really
us all the names. It. Tell us your grandfather's name, your father's name, and then your his brothers.
Okay. My grandfather was James Barden Wooten. They called him Jim or Pop. Everybody called him Pop for many years. And there was Jim Jr. There was Keith. There was Donald, who was my father. There was Sam. And there was Robert, and there was Frank, who was always called Bit. And Jim was the oldest. He was the one that became a barber. So, yeah. So
now, did they all race at the same track? Did they have competing kennels? How did that work?
They never had competing kennels. They, of course, in the early years, were all racing for their father's dogs, greyhounds. My father, early years, was in Florida. They did the circuit, as you know, back then it was very seasonal. So the circuit for my dad and my mother, when they married, was Florida, Colorado, Pueblo, Colorado, and Arizona. That was primarily their route. And then my uncles, I had one that was in Oregon primarily. Oregon, Arizona, that circuit. And then there was Robert. They kind of went wherever Pop wanted them to go. But my dad spent more time in Florida and Arizona than anywhere else. So, yeah. But all of the states where there was racing, the Wootons were there, pretty much.
And was the name of the kennel the Wooten Kennel, or did it have a commercial name?
The Wooten Kennel.
Yeah. Now, before we get further into racing, a question occurs about your grandfather's greyhound that he hired out to help with pest control with the jackrabbits. Does your family record that greyhound's name? Do you remember what the name
was? No, and you know what? It's in the family folklore. I really truly believe that it happened, but there's nothing in the records, no photographs.
No photos, anything like that. Mm-mm. Yeah,
I
that's
know.
Too bad.
That'd have been great.
Well, let's get into your earliest memory. When did you, your family, you and your mom and dad, leave Tucson? You lived there. It sounds like that was kind of your home base, and then you would travel on the circuit. What age were you, and what years were these when you started traveling with your parents?
Well, here's what happened. My dad traveled. And my mother traveled with him before I was born. But my dad was a very practical individual. When I was born, and then when my brother 2 years later was born, my dad said, you know what, this chasing the Greyhound circuit is not going to work for us. It's not a stable life. I don't want that for my family. So that's when he went to work for the Greyhound racetracks in Arizona. He was hired first as an assistant plant superintendent in Phoenix and then a full plant superintendent in Tucson. So forevermore, he did not have a kennel, a racing kennel, but he did work for the Greyhound racetracks in administration from everything. Well, he rose to the ranks of director of racing. It was his highest rank, but presiding steward, presiding judge. So yeah, that was his role. Mm-hmm. So we were pretty stable. We didn't travel like my cousins did from track to track, following the circuit. So, yeah.
And what was your, when did you start going to the track on anything approaching a regular basis? Did you accompany your dad to work from time to time?
Well, here's the deal. We lived, at the Tucson Graham Park. So, when the races were on, and by the way, no surprise, but back in the 50s and 60s, Greyhound Racetrack in Tucson and elsewhere, that was the entertainment in the town. There was nothing else. There was no competition. So every night there was racing, the parking lot was absolutely full. The grandstand, the whole plant was absolutely full of people, you know, partying and betting and just having a really great time. So my recollection is every night there was a lights, camera, action, you know, with the dogs all dressed up and prancing around. And I was at the paddock fence every night because I would like to say I was there to admire the dogs. But frankly, I was there to admire the guys, and they were all guys walking the dogs around, preparing them for their, you know, race, getting their urine samples, if you will, and blanketing them. And then the lead outs would come and take them, you know, and parade them on the track. So I spent many a night standing at the paddock fence. I was not allowed in those days. Children were not allowed into the racetrack at all. So my parents would, my mom would dress up and go and party, and she was very social. So she always had a great time in the clubhouse of the track. And my dad was usually working and visiting. He was a very friendly guy too. So they were inside the gates of the track. I was outside the gates, even from a young age. I was kind of, you know, like on my own. And so was my brother. He was off doing whatever he was doing, which I can't really say. I don't know.
But, and so when you were leaning over the paddock fence, were you on the track grounds, or could you kind of do that without, you know, breaking the rules, so to speak?
Well, I was on the outside looking in. I was outside the paddock fence. So I was not inside. So it was perfectly legal, if you will. I wasn't sneaking around or doing anything like that. I was a good girl. I didn't try to break the rules. But that when I look back, I think, well, that was really weird. To every night, I mean, it was my job to stand there and hold the fence up and, you know, watch, you know, admiring the high school boys. I was much younger, of course. So
now, did how did the lead outs dress back then? Uniforms have changed a good bit over the years.
Well, I can tell you that they were called now, these are not the lead outs, but the veterinary assistants, vet techs, they called them. They all wore white lab coats. And they were, mm-hmm. you know, crisp white lab coats, walking the greyhounds around to catch their urine samples with cups on a stick. But the lead outs did have uniforms then, unlike in current days where they wear shorts with a, you know, a polo top or something. Back then, they wore, you know, rather fancy, not as fancy as maybe even in the 30s, but fancy enough outfits. And again, that was mostly that.
And then at what age were you what age were you allowed to go into the track?
I think back then it was what? I don't know, maybe 18 or 21. I don't know, because I'm going to tell you honestly, after we moved away from the racetrack, my dad was promoted to a judge position, and he was no longer the track superintendent, which meant we no longer had the perk of living on site in a house on the racetrack mm-hmm. grounds. We moved to a rental house across town in Tucson, and I didn't see as much of the track then because, well, I was, you know, freshman in high school by that time, and I had other interests. And again, to be very honest, I moved away from greyhound racing for many, many years and lived where there wasn't even any racing. So I didn't develop or redevelop my interest in the history of greyhound racing until I was probably in my 30s. So there's a gap there.
Now, before we move to that, when you lived on the track grounds and so forth, did you have a pet greyhound, or did you develop a particular interest in some of the greyhounds that you would see repeatedly?
Well, we did have a couple of pet greyhounds in the early days. My father, who had been training his dad's dogs, he said, when I retire, which is now, I'm moving to the racetrack. He loved a dog named Fleetfoot Sam. It was a beautiful black greyhound. He said, I want Sam. I want to take Sam with me as a pet. His dad said, well, okay, you know. So Sam lived with us in our house at the, you know, Greyhound Park. And also we had a greyhound, a brindle, named Peggy. I don't remember what her racing name was. I don't know if she was a favorite, but we had Peggy and Sam as pet greyhounds in the early 50s. And, you know, when I look back, I think, wow, that was, you know, also kind of odd, because really, as you probably know, greyhounds were not petted out so much back then. But
yeah.
We had pets. I don't remember too many greyhounds at the track in those days when I stood by the paddock fence, probably because I was too busy looking at the boys, but whatever.
So. Now, in the meantime, you say you moved back into greyhound, your interest redeveloped in greyhound racing in your 30s. What brought that about?
Well, what really happened was I I went back to get a master's degree in writing at the university. And I had some really neat mentors there. They said, "You come from where? Where did you grow up? In what kind of environment?" And when I told them this, they said, "Oh my gosh, you need to be writing about this. It's like a part of Americana that no one's written about. No one even knows anything about, but it's really, you know, it's an important part of our American history, American racing anyway." And I realized, you know what, I've been ignoring my own heritage. I have ignored it all these years, and I went on to careers and et cetera. But I realized I did need to be and want to write about my history, my family history, and the history of greyhound racing. So that's when I started writing. I think my very first writing was to nominate my grandfather into the pioneer section of the Greyhound Hall of Fame. I wrote his nomination. I gathered all the information, did the research. I was very good at research and writing. So I like to think that I helped get him into the, you know, into the pioneer section of the Hall of Fame. And when he was inducted, that was my first trip to Abilene. That would have been in about 2004. And I got a number. By then, my father had passed away. He died in 1998. But my mother and I, and I got my cousins from Florida who'd been in racing, my cousin Ruth Wooten from Arizona who'd been in racing. I got as many of the Wooten family to come to that induction as possible. And it was a great, great time. And I realized, wow, I love this. And so that was my first meet. And then I continued going to all the meets, almost every meet for a good, well, up through about 2015. Yeah. So that's how I got started.
What was your motivation continuing to go, just to see old friends in the greyhound racing business, or do you just like the Abilene environment?
Well, it was really fun, first of all. The greyhound people are really a fun bunch. And back in the day, there was, everybody would gather in a certain bar after the day's racing, and everybody would share these stories. And I just found the people really interesting. And I guess by then I was feeling a little nostalgic, as some people do, about their history. My dad was gone. Yeah. I wanted to honor his devotion to the greyhound racing environment. And he actually, before he died, he did get Alzheimer's, but he had encouraged me to write and to share some of the family stories. And so probably I was, you know, thinking of him as I continued to return. And he used to go to every single meet for about 20 years prior to that. During his working life, he was on the board of, the Hall of Fame board and whatnot. So I was carrying on the family tradition that way.
What are some of the other things you wrote early on after you wrote your grandfather's, the nomination of your grandfather to the pioneer section of the Hall of Fame?
I was thinking about that. I must have also met personally Gary Gouchon at that time. You know what? I have the greatest respect for him. He was the editor of the Greyhound Review, and also, you know, headed up the the National Greyhound Association. And I think I must have said to him, I'd like to write about some of the people and greyhounds in racing history. And he said, sure. He said, yeah, send me something. So I don't even remember what my first article was, but he was so welcoming, and he pretty much loved everything I wrote. So it became a tradition that I had a piece published in just about every single issue, monthly issues back then, of the Greyhound Review, starting in about mid, 2005 or so. And I want to say something else about Gary. He is an incredible writer. I don't know if you've read anything that he has written, but he is a he used to write a lot more.
Yeah, I've read everything Gary's written just about, and I agree with you. He's a fan. He's as good a writer as he is nice a person.
He really is. And he wrote often a lot about greyhounds. That was kind of his approach. And he wrote about them very, very well. I tended to, and still think, I like to interview people involved in greyhound racing and in greyhound pet adoption also. And I like to tell their stories. The dogs, of course, always come into the story because greyhounds are very much a part of these folks' lives. But yeah, so, and Gary's was a very good editor too. I mean, there were sometimes when he said, you know, maybe that story's a little, you know, not appropriate. Sometimes I wrote stories that maybe were going to get too many people too upset, like about the 1975 strikes that I was very interested in. When the, you know, greyhound trainers and trainers went on strike, so to speak, against greyhound management. So,
yeah.
So he at first didn't really want to publish that, and then eventually the piece did get published because, you know, so what? It's history, right?
Did your column have a title? Of course, each individual one had a title about who it was about, yeah. But it was did you have an overall title for the continuing column?
We went through several in the beginning. No. It was just, you know, byline was Leslie Wooten, author. But in time, we got this thing going on where every time I was in Abilene, I would interview somebody and we called it Lunch with Leslie, which, you know, because I would sit down and have a meal. Did we have a meal? I don't know, John, but I think I interviewed you in Abilene?
You actually interviewed me at the Greyhound, what used to be called the North American Greyhound Adoption Conference.
Okay.
And that was my recollection is it was 2007 in the one held in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Okay.
And it was really one of the best ones I think they ever put on.
Wow.
And you approached me. I think we had met before and you approached me and said, I would like to interview you. I had in my law practice, I'd taken thousands of depositions over the years, but nobody had ever, you know, questioned me.
Yeah.
So it was quite a different experience, but we did it we sat in a little alcove in the hotel meeting room area after the evening's festivities were over for the adoption conference, and we had the best conversation. And you just asked me questions, and I told you a little bit about my background in greyhounds and greyhound adoption and so forth. And I think you followed it up. We had a phone call once we both got home, but it was my 15 minutes of fame. I always like to say.
Well, that's usually how I approached people. I would go, even if I didn't know them, I usually knew something about them and knew beforehand that I did want to interview them. So I would go up and just, you know, introduce myself and say, I'd really like to, you know, would you be interested in me interviewing you or something like that? And sometimes people were quite shy and they weren't used to that sort of approach. And in some cases, they weren't sure who I was. And sometimes they had to, like Keith Dillon, when I went up to him and asked him, I'm not sure he knew I was okay. And he was a thoughtful man. So he said, well, I'll get back to you. And I think he probably checked around and found out that, yeah, I was okay. And so he said, yes, let's do it. And so we did. But I had the Lunch with Leslie series. And then at some point, started doing Spotlight on Women because I felt that women needed to be highlighted. And I ended up interviewing a number of women anyway. And I still think somehow there is a book in that, but I don't know if I'll ever gather the energy to get that done. But I would like to see a collection of essays about women in racing because, you know, it was always...
Did you ever have anybody refuse an interview?
No, I never did. No,
that's good. That's good. And what was your most memorable interviewee, other than me, of course?
Yeah, you.
Who do you think was your most interesting, intriguing interviewee?
Well, they were all so interesting, but I would say probably Keith Dillon, and you know, he was in his 90s when I interviewed him, but he was sharp as a tack. He had excellent recall of his entire life history, and not to mention massive scrapbooks at his home. He invited me to his home and a trophy room and all of that. And, you know, not only was it one article wasn't enough. His life was so extensive that it took three issues of the Greyhound Review. It was about an 8,000 word profile of him. And he was just fascinating because he was involved in so many different facets from such an early, like he was like starting in the 40s was when he started his racing career. And, you know, I was, and he had documented it well with photographs and all of that. And besides having a great recall and memory, and, you know, I thought as while I was interviewing, if only I had spent more time interviewing my, you know, talking to my grandfather, who I really didn't talk to much before he passed. And my dad, well, you know, I had some history about him because I grew up with him. But, you know, so I would say probably Keith Dillon. But his trainer, who was retired when I interviewed him, Jim Schultes, had to be one of the funniest guys I ever interviewed. And I interviewed both of them for hours and hours and hours. And Jim Schultes, I never met. We just talked on the phone for hours and hours and hours. And it's like, you almost become like, I don't know, you get really close with each other. And I didn't meet him until the book was done. And we met in Abilene when the book was, you know, ready to show and share. So funny, funny guy. Humorous. You know, some people have a great sense of humor. He was one.
Leslie, most of our American listeners probably know Keith Dillon and his contributions, but for our international listeners, tell us a little bit about Keith's contributions to the Greyhound breed and Greyhound racing.
Okay, well, he didn't raise very many Greyhounds, but the ones that he raised were absolutely fantastic racers, almost to all of them, including Kiefer, of course, but he had some other really super, super Greyhounds. So there's that. But he also was very instrumental in getting the Greyhound Hall of Fame going. Before he got involved, it was really nothing. And he felt that it was important to have the Hall of Fame. And so he was instrumental in getting the land for it, in getting the funding for it. He very grassroots and you know, really, really beat the pavements getting funding for that and heading it up for probably at least a couple years. He also was very involved in, and I believe, as I recall, invented the Jackalure that he used in training the Greyhounds so that, you know, they could forego using live rabbits, which they had used. Because he knew that the handwriting was on the wall, that really they needed a more, what one might say, humane approach to training Greyhounds. So he was the inventor, I guess, of that. And then he was always right there in Kansas, where the Greyhound Hall of Fame was, of course, and then the National Greyhound Association. And he was very vocal and supportive of racing in general, but he wanted it done the right way, working with all the folks that needed to be worked with. So that's just a very, very brief highlight of some of the things that he did and contributed.
Mm-hmm. Well, his invention of the Jackalure and its use in training young greyhounds really kind of debunked the old myth that, you know, in order to be advanced achievers on the track, that greyhounds needed to be trained on live jackrabbits. And he kind of just put the myth on that. And his dogs did just as well as those trained on live jackrabbits. And so that's one of the things, the first things I read about him was that he was determined to show that artificial lure training was just as effective as live jackrabbit training. And I think that was a big contribution of his to the sport and its, you know, ability to go forward.
Definitely. Yes.
Did he do this full time? Was greyhound racing his full time business and occupation?
Yes, it was. It definitely was.
Almost. That's amazing. You could do it raising 20 greyhounds a year.
Yeah. Yeah, it was. And how he did it, of course. And he raced at the best racetracks too. I mean, you know, St. Petersburg in Florida, Derby Lane, and also then Southland. Yeah, he was there.
Did he have his own kennels, or did he lease his dogs to selected trainers?
No. He had his own trainer, Jim Schultes, for the majority of the years, certainly during Kiefer's years, and his own kennels. He never farmed any out. No. Mm-mm. He did.
What was the name of his kennels? Dillon Kennel?
Keith Dillon.
Did he have a?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Keith Dillon Kennels. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Well, this is a good segue for us to talk about your Greyhound book. And I have my own copy right here. I'm going to hold it up. Kiefer, The People's Choice.
Yeah.
Tell us about how you decided to write that book and why you chose Kiefer.
Are we okay on the sound?
Yeah.
Because I thought maybe, I thought maybe that sound had cut off. Okay. Well, after writing that three-part, really long profile of Keith Dillon, I did ask him at some point, who was your favorite greyhound? And he said Kiefer. And I think this came out in the book, but he told me that, you know, Hollywood had wanted to make a movie of Kiefer. They had approached him about making it a big-time movie. But Keith was a person very much in control, wanted to be. He told them that, yeah, you can make a movie of Kiefer, but I want to be able to, you know, be right there with you in the editing, and I want to see the final before it goes out, and I want a very big part in it. They said, no way. No. That's not going to happen. So he said,
because they no doubt wanted to change the story somewhat to make it a little more appealing or whatever. Although Kiefer had a great story on his own.
He did. And so Keith, that was the end of the movie. And he said that Kiefer was probably his favorite because he had such an incredible personality. Almost from the time he was born, somehow, you know, Keith held him as a little puppy, tiny newborn in his hands, and somehow he felt, and I don't know how he felt, but he said, this is the one. This is the one. He held it out, even to the vet, because the mom had to have cesarean section. So he was there with the vet when the pups were born, when Kiefer was born. And somehow he just knew, and Kiefer didn't fail him on that. He went out. He loved racing, but he loved people, maybe even more. So he was a great fan favorite. They came out in droves to see him at Derby Lane primarily. That's where he raced the most, although he did race, you know, elsewhere as well. But
give us a little highlights and tell us what were the years of Kiefer's racing career?
Oh, these are tough questions. Early 80s. Your early 80s, yeah. Like 84, 85, were his biggest years. Mm-hmm.
And give us some highlights of his career.
Well, he won the Derby Lane Classics 2 years in a row, which was unheard of. And he was a closer, you know. He was the kind of greyhound that would often be at the very back, you know, or could be in the very back. He could go wire to wire at the head. But what the most thrilling was, I understand, was when he came from behind, and then he would just pass like he was playing with the other greyhounds, and in the big, big races that counted, he would do that. And you know, and he was never real stressed out like some greyhounds can get. You know, he just seemed to really play at the racing and running, but he was focused. But it was his ability to charm people that his trainer found most amusing. But, you know, so I would say the Derby Lane Classics were his biggest wins, but he won a lot of big stakes races. I mean, it was just those two come most prevalently to mind, because those were the only two videos that I was able to find and to watch and to see him actually racing, you know. But I, after writing my book, I still get occasionally notes from people who said, we saw him run. And it was the most thrilling thing ever. And, you know, how astonishing is that? You know, there've been other great greyhounds. In fact, Perceive, his father, was a fantastic racer, but he didn't have the personality that Kiefer did. And maybe he was a brindle, Brindle, and maybe he didn't stand out like that great big fawn greyhound that Kiefer was. So
yeah.
So
did they take advantage of his personality plus and use him for, you know, public relations type events, or parade him up in the grandstand from time to time, that sort of thing? Have him on TV?
Yes, he was on TV. That's absolutely right. And he was on some local talk shows. Yes. Yeah, so Derby Lane utilized him for marketing purposes. Yeah, mm-hmm, definitely. And he enjoyed
it. What was Jim Schultes's take on, Kiefer's greatness and what made him such a, you know, accomplished athlete?
Well, just, of course, he had the great, great, his father, Perceive, and his mother was a great racer as well. So they had been really impressive on the racetrack. But he just, I don't know if Kiefer was Jim Schultes's favorite greyhound, but he understood his popularity and personality, and he played that up whenever possible. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, I think he thinks maybe Perceive was his father. Kiefer's father was a better racer, one that was always business. You know, Kiefer was a little playful. So, yeah. If you ever got a chance, I mean, Jim Schultes, he's maybe not well enough to do interviews anymore, but he was sure a funny interviewee. We might just get you.
Where is he living now? We might just get you to liaison for us.
Yeah. Okay. I need
you
to
know
reach
where
out
he
to him
where
anyway.
He is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's in Arkansas now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very good.
Living on
so
Lake
what,
of the Ozarks.
What did Where did Kiefer go after he finished racing? Did he do stud duty, or did he go back to live with Mr. Dillon, or what was the rest of his life like?
He did go back to live with Mr. Dillon, and they were hoping he would be a great stud, as great a racer, great a stud as he was a racer. But the very interesting thing was he was a total flop as a stud. He really didn't produce any major winners, none.
How about
and
that?
I think that was probably very disappointing for Keith Dillon. Perceive, his father, was one of the best studs ever. Kiefer, no. I don't think there's one greyhound that's in the history books, if you will, that was an offspring of his. But I did meet people who said that one of their favorite greyhounds was, for example, a female that was his daughter. White Ruffles was her name, and she had a great personality.
How about that? And so did he just live out his life at Keith's farm?
He did. He did.
What year did he pass away? Do you remember?
I don't remember. I'm sorry to say. He lived. He didn't live in a too long of a life, but he lived, 7 or 8. I mean, it was under 10, I'm sure. But I'm sorry. It was a while ago that I wrote that, and I haven't read my book for a while.
So let's talk about the writing of the book. How did you go about it? Did you have a publisher when you started, or did you decide you might self-publish it, or what? Just give us the mechanics a little bit about writing the book.
The mechanics of it were this. The funnest part, as any writer probably knows, is the research. It's always really fun to research, and I love talking to people and interviewing them and asking them questions. So I spent hours and hours and hours interviewing Keith Dillon, trainer Jim Schultes, and also other people, the journalists who wrote beautifully about him. There were a couple of guys that were fantastic writers and were on the scene writing about Kiefer. So I had all of their works, and I interviewed them as well. And a number of people who, were either, mostly people around the track, like one of the greatest Irish, why is his name blanking? But you probably know his name. He was an Irish trainer.
Mick Darcy?
Yes, I interviewed him on the phone. Most of these were phone interviews only, where I never met the people in person till, you know, later. But so I knew that I wanted, I started in the fall of 2006, and I knew that Keith Dillon was older. I didn't know how long he had to live, but I wanted to get the book done so he could see the finished product. So I had the book completed within 6 months, but that was my whole life. That was my whole life.
Yeah, yeah.
7 days a week, about maybe 12 hours a day. I was either researching, I finished the research, and then I started writing. Writing was, has always been my, I've always been good at it, but it's, I'm a perfectionist. So, it took me, you know, a long time to write the book in my mind, but I got it where I wanted it. It was ready to share with Keith and with Jim. I sent them, you know, the manuscript and let them, you know, respond to me, but there were some corrections, but not a whole lot. And then it was ready to go to press. I sent it to about 10 publishers. There was nobody that, I mean, and I could have kept sending it because, you know, there's hundreds of publishers out there.
Yeah.
But I decided that I would self-publish because I wanted the book to be published so Keith could enjoy it. And I found I was referred to some really great folks, a couple that specialize in publishing books. And then, you know, I told them I wanted the book to look professional and to look good. They helped me place all the photos and get it set up. This was before self-publishing was all that easy to find and do.
Yeah.
It was a lot more expensive.
It's much easier now, isn't
it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Much easier. It wasn't then. But the book you have in your hand, I'm proud of. I think it looks beautiful.
Let's hold that up again. It's a beautiful book. I mean, it's really well laid. Like you say, it's well laid out. It's professional looking. Of course, the writing is superb.
Yes. Thank you. So I wanted the book to be ready to take to the spring meet. So I had, you know, started in the fall and I wanted to, and I did take it to the spring meet. I had a little video made of the book kind of for marketing purposes. And in the spring of 2007, Keith Dillon, Jim Schultes, and myself came together for the first and probably only time in many years. And we autographed books. And I talked about the book and showed the film to folks at the Greyhound Hall of Fame. I don't know if you were there. You might have been, but
I think I was.
I did all the marketing for my book. I figured, look, I spent quite a lot of money getting it published. I want to get that money back. I recoup my money, and so I did heavy duty marketing. I did receptions at Phoenix Greyhound Park, Tucson Greyhound Park, at the Hall of Fame. And I went on the road with my book, so to speak, and you know, I did recoup my expenses, and it's there's still a few of those books that you have in your hand circulating around. I have a few. By the way, it was important to me to donate. You know, as my book says, I donate for every book I sell. I donate a portion to assist Greyhound pet adoption. So that was important for me to do that. And I did.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
And it's still available on Amazon, correct?
It's available. Yes. It's available as an ebook now. And it's available as a, you know, paperback as well. So,
yeah, that's one thing I've always wondered. Did you, as the author, have to do anything to get it in an ebook or Kindle or iPad or that sort of thing, that form? I've always wondered if that how easy that is to transform a book from a paper book to an ebook.
Well, the folks, I think the Gorham Printing Company that printed my first books, after I was getting really low on the stock of the original printing, I called them, contacted them, and said, what can I do? I'd like it in an ebook. So they put it in that format for me, told me how to upload it and, you know, do all of that on Amazon. And And then they also helped me to, you know, get the book. It's now in a different form. It's not as pretty as what you have in your hand, but it's functional. Mm-hmm. It's a functional book. And the ebook is good enough, you know. And yeah. So, right. It was...
Do you have any idea how many copies have sold, total copies have sold?
No, I don't. I really don't. I occasionally get a, you know, Amazon takes a pretty big chunk of your commission. I think, as I recall, it's about 60% and I get 40. So do the math, you know, on a book. It's like, yeah, I get a few pennies royalty now and then.
Do you get a report quarterly, monthly, et cetera, about how many they've sold?
It's online and I could check, but you know, it's Kiefer, it did its work back in the day and it's still doing some work, but you know, I don't keep track of it much anymore.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if you know this, but I've checked and it's the, to my knowledge, it's the only book written about a particular single individual greyhound. There's plenty of great books about greyhounds in general. Of course, Charlie Blanning's, you know, Greyhound and the Hare and Please Mister and so forth. But it covers, you know, it's those are historical books which cover all the great ones. But as far as I can tell, yours is the only one about a single individual greyhound. So you have that you have that distinction to be proud of.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, you remember Linda Jensen?
Yes.
Who is now passed on. She loved the book. She loved the idea of Kiefer. And we had a chat one time and she said, you know, we got to see if we can get this made into a movie. So, and we both agreed that the actor we wanted to play Keith Dillon was Robert Duvall, who I love as
an
actor.
Yes. Oh, he would be great. And he actually, they kind of look alike a little bit.
They do. So we reached out. She found his address in Virginia, I believe, where he lives. And we wrote to him.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you hear back?
We did hear back. He said he wasn't, he didn't specifically say not interested in the Kiefer book per se, but that he wasn't doing movies at the present time or, you know, so he didn't take the project on, but
yeah,
wouldn't it have been nice if he had, cause he's a perfect guy.
Really. Oh yeah, yeah. Yeah. Did you hear back from him actually, or more like his agent or his manager or?
You know, I don't believe I heard directly from him, or that would be framed, right? And, you know, I'd look at it every day. So it was from a publicist, no doubt.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite all-time actors. I'll see just about anything that he's in. Mm-hmm. And he's great.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So
do you think you have another book in you?
Well, you know, it would be great if I did, but I don't know if I have the energy for it. It's, you know, writing is such an isolating, it's very, you know, you go in a room and you're all by yourself and I don't know if I have that concentration anymore, but I think I was talking to you two. I think, remember the title? I wanted to name Bitches of Greyhound Racing.
About the women in greyhound racing.
I wanted the women, but I wanted, you know, but it could also be the, and I said, Gary Gouchon and I ought to write the book. He would do the greyhounds because he's great at doing, you know, writing about greyhounds. And I would write about the women. So
That's a great theme.
But you know, I think he's moved on too. I think he's having too much fun golfing and, you know, traveling the world. So
and sending me political jokes. Gary sends some.
Does
of
he
this.
Do that?
Most of them are political, but some of them are not. And he's. I'm lucky to be on his list of people mm-hmm. that he forwards these various jokes to, and there's not a bad one among them.
That's neat.
Now let's get to you kind of segued from your column in the Greyhound Review about people or that sort of thing, and you did, and I don't remember whether this was in the Greyhound Review or you did it on your own. Anyway, you did kind of an investigative series on Grey 2K. The anti-racing group. Tell us a little bit about what how that came about and how you went about doing your research.
Well, you know, I loved interviewing people and writing profiles of them. That's my forte to this day. That's what I love. Investigative research, Not so much. It's not my favorite, but I had learned how to do it, and I do it pretty well. But I was approached to write those reports, do the investigation and the reports. I was looking at my notes. Who approached me? It was the first was to look into, you know, president of Grey 2K, the anti-racing group, Christine Dorshak's history, to kind of confirm or refute her version of her history. So that was funded by people in Greyhound Racing, and some Greyhound adoption folks funded that. They came to me, asked me, would I be interested and would I write in research and write a report? And I said, well, I said, okay. And I did it. And I actually, I went to Boston, where Christine Dorshak and her headquarters are. And I went to the courthouse. I mean, I went and got court documents, from, you know, her court case from when she was, in the train accident. Some of this is going to sound real general, but, her version of history is a little different than what the history that I found in doing my hands-on research in Boston. So I did a lot of research, and then I wrote a report, basically refuting some of her commentary. You know, I don't want to put Grey 2K down, because what I'm going to say is they're well organized, you know, very organized, and they know how to put on a united front, and they're very successful in what they did. Her personal history, she changed it up to suit her needs, I presume. And it worked. I mean, you know, to this day, more people know her story from her point of view than they know maybe perhaps either the true story or from my point of view, from the research I did. You know, very few people mm-hmm. saw that report outside of the Greyhound racing world. So, but it's
remind me, was it published in the Greyhound Review? I don't remember.
I don't think the whole thing was. It was too long. And yeah. Let me just see. I do have notes here somewhere about where it was published. I shared it with all the people who had funded, and it was a wide variety of people who had contributed funding. I'll just tell you here real quick. I don't know.
I know that I saw it at some point, and I just can't remember. You may have sent it to me, or other folks in Greyhound Adoption may have sent it to me.
Yeah. Leading the Grey 2K charge, it was a report prepared for the Florida Greyhound Association in November of 2013.
Yeah.
And then Life After Racing in the USA, a report prepared for the Greyhound Pets of America, actually, March 2011. And then I had a follow-up on the Tucson situation in 2014, funded by the United Greyhound Racing. American Greyhound Racing provided some funding as well. So those reports are still available, and I still get occasionally someone saying, boy, that was a great report you wrote. But, you know.
Well, as you look back on it, as you did your investigative report, and of course, hindsight's always 20/20, but what have you given any thought to what Greyhound Racing might have done differently to combat what really is a basically dishonest advocacy of Grey 2K and their supporting organizations? Have you given any thought to what might have been a more effective campaign to oppose them?
Yes. Greyhound Racing, folks involved in Greyhound Racing should have been as united as Grey 2K was united. And, you know, it's easy to say that, but people involved in Greyhound Racing have never been able to come together in a cohesive, you know, as cohesively as they needed to, to, you know, charge against the folks trying to bring them down. But I don't think it was just anti-racing folks like Grey 2K that brought them down. I think that, you know, the Greyhound Racing men and women had other battles too, and they battled with the track managers and owners who mm-hmm. once gaming was brought into the picture, they looked at greyhounds and the people who raced them as, that's too much trouble. Let's do away with that and just, focus on poker and slot machines and all that. It's a lot easier. Live racing is expensive. And then, it was a combination of things. But I think that, unfortunately, the people of greyhound racing just didn't have the money either that some of the folks in horse racing do to fight back. And they were never as united as they needed or should have been. And I don't think they had the funds to mm-hmm. to fight it like Grey 2K with all their lawyers. And, got to give them credit. They're very good at what they do.
Yeah.
I don't know how that sounds, but.
What do you think? So that's the past. Where do you think greyhound racing here in the U.S. is going? What future do you see for it?
Well, I know some people in greyhound racing, they're friends of mine, and I love them for this positivism, thinking it will continue somehow. I'm not so optimistic. I think greyhound racing, as it has been, commercial greyhound racing is a thing of the past. And it's sad for me to say that, but it is. I think there will be racing. It might be underground racing. It might be illegal, like there is quite a bit of racing going on in horse racing, But I don't know. I'm sad to say I'm not hopeful, and I think they've got too much against them. And what do you think?
I don't know. Well, I've wondered if it just may it ultimately will in the next 5-10 years go away completely and then be brought back in some mm-hmm. way. Mm-hmm. With the kind of a redone business model, maybe not depending so much on parimutuel wagering. Certainly I think that'll always be the economic engine. That's the truth. That's true worldwide. But I've always said that I wish they had not de-emphasized the sport aspect mm-hmm. of it to the detriment of the racing, because I think you'll get more spectators through the turnstiles or even mm-hmm. watching it online if you re-emphasize the sporting aspect, because in the early days and even in its glory days, there was as many people interested in it because of the sport aspect with the individual dogs that everybody liked to mm-hmm. follow and so forth as the gambling. And right. so that's what gets spectator mm-hmm. interest. And it doesn't have to be necessarily everybody at the tracks. Mm-hmm. It can be, sports are watched in a variety of ways mm-hmm. now, mm-hmm. Online, TV, et cetera. And I think if they could capitalize on that in a kind of a remodeled form, that they might be able to bring it back here in the U.S. Mm-hmm. We're all just speculating. We don't know for sure, but that's one way that uh-huh. it possibly could be brought back.
And I'm sure there are some people that could make that happen. I know, well, we won't name any names, but there's some people who are still very, very, very positive about racing and its possibilities. Yeah. And I'm happy for that. I am.
I had a friend the other day tell me, somebody, we need a multi-billionaire to come in and, buy one track or build a track facility just from scratch and do everything right. And of course that's fantasy, but it yes. would take, I believe it would take, just as we see in horse racing, you got to have some folks that have some money, some big money. Exactly. And I don't know whether that will come about or not. It's a shame. It really is a shame. Thankfully, greyhound racing seems to be doing well in Ireland and England and Australia. And we mm-hmm. just hope that'll continue for the sake of the breed.
Mm-hmm. And what I always wished was emphasized more was just how far greyhound racing has come. When you think about it in terms of pet adoption, they went from not adopting any greyhounds, which is true history, to adopting, well over 90%, 95% plus of adoptable greyhounds. And what other, I mean, your average mutt on the street, I mean, very few, a lot of them are euthanized. I mean, so greyhound racing, someone, maybe that's the book I should have written, you know, to really focus and emphasize that. Because that is, that's truly an impressive story. You know,
that's really, if you think about it, the ironic shame of it here in the U.S. Just at the time where we had reached 100% adoption. In fact, we probably you could say we were over 100% in the sense of having more people that wanted to adopt a greyhound than there were greyhounds available. So we had reached the pinnacle of that aspect of the welfare of the racing greyhound just at the time when, you know, other forces brought it down. And that's the great ironic shame of it. All these greyhounds now are being adopted. They were bringing companionship and joy into the lives of lots and lots of people. And now, you know, that's not really available to the extent that it used to be.
Yes. And you're right.
Well, Leslie, we hope to see you this year at the, you coming back to the, Heart of America Greyhound Gathering in Abilene?
I would like to. Is that in June?
Yeah, that's in June. And are you still planning on going? Do you still attend the national meetings in April and October?
I haven't been to one since 2015. And I would like to. You know, it might rekindle my desire to, you know, write another book.
Yeah, there you go.
Or an article, at least.
And maybe someday we'll get Kiefer at the movies, because certainly his story is as good as the great racehorses of history that they've made movies about.
That is right. Yes.
Well, Leslie, it's been a great hour or so to spend with you. Great conversation. Thank you so much for joining us. And folks, remember, you can get Amazon. You can go to Amazon and get Kiefer, The People's Choice. It's a great book about a great greyhound. Leslie, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you're not a regular listener, be sure to follow Greyhound Nation wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on social media, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Just search for Grey Nation Show, follow us, and you'll get notifications every time we release a new episode. You can also get a new show notification when you subscribe to our brand new YouTube channel. If you like the episode, leave us a review on our Facebook page or your favorite podcast app. You can also send us feedback or questions via the contact form on our website at greyhoundnation.dog. That's greyhoundnation.dog. This episode was produced in collaboration with host John Parker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dimitri Taras. Thanks to our guest this episode, Leslie Wooten. Leslie's book, Kiefer, The People's Choice, can be purchased on Amazon in Kindle and paperback formats. I'm Michael Burns, and you've been listening to Greyhound Nation.